The president wanted me to apply for the Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Initiatives, and it's just really important for the trans community at this particular point in time to have that kind of visibility.
I associate the term lazy with the person who was an activist lying in the streets in 1990 and then realizing, like, well, do I really have time to go to that protest? It's not someone who doesn't care anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's someone who's gotten comfortable.
Now I'm fascinated.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Canadian Anglicans defiantly bless marriage equality, faith-fortified trans activist advises Obama, and midlife and lost love as seen through a lazy eye. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending July 16th, 2016. A narrow vote by more than 200 delegates attending the triennial six-day General Synod 2016 of the Anglican Church of Canada this week would allow their ministers to bless the unions of same-gender couples in church ceremonies. Initial reports had the resolution failing by one vote, but after several delegates complained of voting irregularities, a recount revealed that it had passed, although just barely. Both the bishops and lay delegates had voted to support the resolution by 68% and 72%, respectively, but the original result showed only 66.23% of clergy in support, literally one vote short of the required two-thirds majority. When the votes were recounted, however, it was discovered that General Secretary Michael Thompson's vote had been counted as a lay vote instead of clergy. The reversal made it the one additional vote needed to pass the resolution. According to the Canadian press, about 1.6 million Canadians identify themselves as Anglican, which claims about 2,800 congregations across the country.
The resolution still needs to be reaffirmed at the next synod of the Canadian wing of the Global Anglican Communion in 2019 before it becomes official church law. Civil marriage has been open to gay and lesbian couples in the country since 2005. But the vast majority of Anglican officials in what's called the Global South, Latin America, Africa, and Asia, are staunchly opposed to LGBT rights and are bound to pressure their Canadian counterparts to reverse the vote in 2019. Earlier this year, Anglicans punished the Episcopal Church, the U.S. wing of the Communion, after it voted to allow its ministers to officiate the weddings of same-gender couples. The theological Anglican divide over the inclusion of LGBT people in church life has, for the past several years, threatened to tear the Communion apart.
Civil marriage equality continues to be a hot topic in Bermuda. Lawmakers in the independent British Overseas Territories House of Assembly passed a bill to constitutionally ban same-gender couples from getting married earlier in the week. But their counterparts in the Senate rejected the proposal a few days later. The amendment to the Human Rights Act would have stated that none of its provisions can override the Matrimonial Causes Act, which defines civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. The bill was strongly criticized by the country's Human Rights Commission. Bermuda's Royal Gazette newspaper quoted one senator as calling the bill an attempt to degrade human rights rather than affirm them, and said it paralleled historic discrimination against Black people. Voters in the mostly conservative Christian country rejected both civil unions and civil marriage for lesbian and gay couples last month by almost 2-to-1 margins in a non-binding referendum. Only 47% of eligible voters participated, however, and a 50% plus one majority was required for the referendum to have any real impact.
Elsewhere, the U.S. Republican National Convention runs July 18th through 21st in Cleveland, Ohio. Along with the party's expected official nomination of Donald Trump for president, the platform committee has settled on what many critics are calling the most regressive anti-LGBT document in decades. It maintains a strict husband and wife definition of marriage, specifically calls for a constitutional amendment to overturn the June 2015 U.S. Supreme Court marriage equality decision, and says that only judges who respect traditional family values should be appointed to the bench. The platform also supports state laws regulating which bathrooms transgender people are allowed to use, says that parents have the right to pursue so-called conversion therapy to force their LGBT children to be straight and narrow, and demands that religious belief guide the passage of all legislation because man-made law must be consistent with God-given natural rights.
The party platform also declares pornography to be a public health crisis, opposes gun control legislation, endorses Donald Trump's call for the erection of an anti-immigrant wall between the U.S. and Mexico, and describes coal as a clean energy source. The platform committee rejected a proposal to condemn discrimination based on sexual orientation.
In what seemed like a direct slap in the face by the convention hosts, however, the Cleveland City Council passed an ordinance on July 15th that allows trans people to use sex-segregated public facilities, such as bathrooms and locker rooms, which correspond to their gender identity.
Florida Democrat Corrine Brown introduced a resolution in the U.S. House of Representatives more than 2 weeks ago condemning the horrific acts of terrorism and hatred in Orlando and expressing support and prayers for all those impacted. Such resolutions have sadly become routine after deadly attacks like the one at the Pulse nightclub. LGBT activists waited in vain for a resolution to honor the victims of that massacre. But a committee in the GOP-dominated House held hearings on a so-called federal religious freedom bill on July 12, the one-month anniversary of the deadly attack in Orlando. Called the First Amendment Defense Act, it would prohibit the federal government from taking discriminatory action against a person or business with religious beliefs or moral convictions that define marriage as a union between a man and a woman. Equality advocates charge that it would also allow businesses to withhold benefits from LGBT employees, to deny time off to an employee to care for an ailing same-gender spouse, and permit housing discrimination against gay and lesbian couples. Its supporters claim that freedom of religion is under attack in the United States. Congress is currently on a 7-week summer recess.
Meanwhile, the National Basketball Association remains undecided about moving its February 2017 All-Star Game out of Charlotte, North Carolina, because of the state's notorious HB2. The law forbids local governments in the Tar Heel State from protecting their LGBT citizens from discrimination, and requires trans people to use sex-segregated public facilities such as bathrooms that match the gender on their birth certificate. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver told reporters this week that the league's team owners discussed but did not vote on the issue. He said they realize, however, that a decision needs to be made soon. Silver said he was personally disappointed that North Carolina lawmakers didn't make necessary changes to HB2 before they adjourned to make discussion about moving the All-Star Game unnecessary. He reiterated that the law, as it currently exists, is inconsistent with the core values of the league.
A college basketball game has already fallen victim to HB2. The men's team of the Durham, North Carolina-based Duke University Blue Devils was scheduled to host the Albany Great Danes on November 12th as part of the Hall of Fame tip-off tournament. A spokeswoman for the State University of New York system that includes Albany says that the game won't be played, however, because of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's executive order banning state-funded, non-essential travel to North Carolina. Other governors and a number of city officials around the country have also shown their contempt for HB2 with similar travel bans.
In other news, the Gloucester County, Virginia School Board is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the enforcement of an appeals court ruling that ordered the district to allow trans student Gavin Grimm to use campus restrooms based on his gender identity. The school's policy now says that students must use the facilities that reflect their biological gender. Lawyers for the board asked Chief Justice John Roberts this week to issue a stay while they appeal the ruling. If their request is granted, the biological gender bathroom rule would remain in force when Grimm begins the school year in September.
But finally, California's Board of Education has made it the first U.S. state to include LGBT history and culture in public school instruction. It will begin at the elementary school level and continue through middle school and high school. The updated History and Social Science Framework announced on July 14th includes suggested instruction on major LGBT historical figures, important milestones in the struggle for equality, and the evolving character of LGBT communities and identities. Each school district will determine the specific content for their students. The changes stem from passage of the Fair, Accurate, Inclusive, and Respectful Education Act of 2012, which called for important contributions by LGBT Americans and people with disabilities to no longer be excluded from history education. Implementation was delayed by lawsuits filed by right-wing legal groups trying to overturn it. Melissa Goodman, director of the ACLU of Southern California's LGBTQ Gender and Reproductive Justice Project, said in a statement that, "Today, California has taken yet another step to affirm our shared values of inclusivity and fairness."
That's NewsWrap for the week ending July 16th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
Leftover love heats up in the California desert later in the program. Trans activist Barbara Satin is the National LGBTQ Task Force's Assistant Faith Work Director and a former member of the United Church of Christ's Executive Council. Satin told This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend how she recently added an Obama administration position to her credits.
The president wanted me to apply for the Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Initiatives, and I got it. It started basically in the Bush administration, and it was a way in which they were going to, you know, funnel some of the federal money into the faith-based area. The first iteration tried to do a lot of programs and got some things done. The second iteration focused on sex trafficking. We're the third iteration. We're working on poverty issues. And primarily, it's since this is the close of President Obama's time in office, with a Congress that doesn't seem to want to do anything around social action, the idea is, what are some of the things that in the area of poverty that the administration should focus on and get some action going? So I'm coming in sort of at the last portion of this. The group has been meeting for a while. Myself and two other people were just added to the council. My role is going to be, where can I make some additions to that, some help to that? I'm just excited to be a part of it. It's just really important for the trans community at this particular point in time to have that kind of visibility. I think it's really exciting.
You've been very active in housing for queer seniors. Do you think this was part of what spurred people to discover that you were someone who had been an asset to this?
I think that's probably the stimulus to the invitation. I was a presenter at the White House Conference on Senior Housing a year ago, and then I was a delegate to the White House Conference on Aging. For the first time in all of the years the White House Conference on Aging has been going on, they finally invited the queer community. So I was invited to be one of the three delegates. So I think that had something to do with it. And that's one of the issues that's being addressed, but it's being addressed primarily on the element of youth housing, which is very important, sure. But there's not a lot being said about senior housing, and particularly senior affordable housing.
Can you tell us in general what the task force is about?
The task force is an LGBTQ activist group that really is a national organization that works in the communities. We go where organizations that are basically local or state-based ask us to come in and help them, where we think we have some resources and training or other even financial resources where we can help. In fact, some of our staff are in Orlando, and we went there because Florida Equality said, you know, this is overwhelming to us and we're not prepared for this. Can you come and give us some support, some help? Some exciting and really powerful things are coming out of this. Even in the faith-based area, I was listening to one of the staff say that she, as a black lesbian, was asked to go to a gathering of black churches, conservative churches, and asked to talk about life experience, lived experience that black LGBT people face. And at the end, one of the preachers got up and said, "We have to rethink our theology." That's words you'd never hear out of, you know, the AME and others. So it's really exciting that people are beginning to see who we are and see the lives that we've had to live and are willing to at least understand a little bit about who we are. Be strong and be confident that there will be good that we will do that will come out of this, that I think will shape and reshape what the culture is around LGBT equality.
Barbara Satin is the newest member of President Obama's Advisory Council on Faith-Based Neighborhood Partnerships. She was interviewed by Dixie Trichel and John Townsend.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Do you have any idea how long I searched for you, Alex?
When I got your email, I thought, how dare he contact me after all these years? But I had to see you.
I needed to see you too. What do you want?
What do I want?
Yeah, it's a simple question. What do you want?
That is not a simple question.
Lazy Eye is the new Tim Kirkman movie that transported OutFest attendees from the Los Angeles LGBT Film Festival to the scenic California desert retreat of Joshua Tree with a story about long-separated lovers. It's not all romance. It's about life questions that This Way Out's Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones raised in their chat with the writer-director.
Growing older is something we're starting to see more stories of reflected back at us. This film isn't explicitly about that, but that was sort of the first thing that I noticed about it. And I wonder if that was something that was on your mind.
Yeah, it was very much on my mind. I mean, there were two things that really were, I would say, the engine behind the story. One of them was the challenges of getting a little older. I remember turning 40 and my eyes changing dramatically, and that was a big thing. And it's just sort of like that period in your life when you're looking back at all the choices that you've made and thinking, like, I have some time left, hopefully, you know, and maybe did I make the right choices? And the other thing was this is my fourth film at OutFest, and the first one was Dear Jesse, which was a documentary, and then The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me, which was a performance film, then Loggerheads, which was a film about a gay adoptee looking for his parents, who was also HIV positive. And with Lazy Eye, I wanted to make a film that had LGBT characters where being queer was not the obstacle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so this was the first time that I'd ever attempted that. So it's about aging, very much, you know, about being middle aged.
They're not that old, are they?
They're not, actually.
But they've changed.
It's approaching middle age. And that's why the eye thing was so critical for me, because it was like, oh, bifocals, great, okay.
And if you were under 45, you do not know what we're talking about.
But you will.
Yeah.
But you will. And of course, go ahead.
So we don't reveal too much. How would you describe the story?
Lazy Eye is about two guys who met in New York City 15 years ago and can reconnect for the first time in 15 years for a weekend in Joshua Tree. You know, it's about so many things. It's about memory. It's about how we remember things. It's about stories. Mm-hmm. It's about how you create stories in order to cope.
Yeah.
Or you know, think about your past and you write a narrative so that mm-hmm. it makes more sense, so that you justify the choices that you've made. And then there's somebody who throws that mirror in front mm-hmm. of you and says, that's not what happened. This is, you know, that's not the memory at all. This is what happened. And so then you have to rewrite it, and that can be pretty uncomfortable.
Do you remember our first actual date? You took me to see this awful movie downtown.
Awful?
Yeah. I was at some artsy theater on Houston about this young boy who falls in love with an old lady.
You don't mean Harold and Maude?
Yes. Oh my God, that film. I just remember thinking to myself, why is this guy taking me to see this?
Okay, stop talking, please.
No, I mean, it was so sad and weird and pretentious.
I am holding a knife here.
And then the Cat Stevens music.
Seriously? Stop. Harold and Maude is my favorite movie of all time.
It's everybody's favorite movie.
I noticed
in Dean's office you had mock-ups, and one of those was Harold and Maude.
Yep. Yes.
Well played,
Harold
sir.
And Maude. I'm glad to. Thank you for noticing, I'm going to say.
I was also curious if you were sort of also bringing in that anxiety that I know a lot of gay men have around sort of turning 40, sort of making peace with that.
It's not something that I was thinking about very much. Actually, I was really thinking more about the universal aspects of it, mostly because I think it was so, when I was confronting it, it was so medical. It was because I have amblyopia as well. I also used to be a graphic designer, and there's some other parallels in the movie. But the thing that, if you have amblyopia, that hits you a little bit earlier.
And amblyopia is?
It's a lazy eye.
Yes.
Lazy eye is the slang for amblyopia.
That was a big deal when I was a little kid, and I haven't heard that term since for decades. And then I saw this movie, I thought, wow, lazy eye's back.
But it was actually more about the universal aspects of life choices more than anything. And so the externalized part of it, which is his eyes have changed. So what else do I need? My vision is changing. How do I need to adjust? You know, that kind of story.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but I also, in the lazy of the lazy eye, what does that mean to you? Like,
I don't know. I just feel like I was writing from a very personal place when I was writing Dean, especially with who he was.
Right.
Well, you're not an artist anymore. You're a graphic designer. Okay, well, I'm not a democratic socialist anymore. Now I have two houses. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, what are sort of the compromises that you make? And I associate the term lazy with becoming complacent, becoming the kind of the person who was an activist lying in the streets in 1990, you know, in New York City. And then realizing like, well, do I really have time to go to that protest? It's not someone who doesn't care anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's someone who's gotten comfortable. And it's also a luxury to be able to do that. Like we could all say like, oh, this is first world problems, right? This is not a movie about Syrian refugees. But it's also, it's a privilege. It's sort of a luxury to be able to be self-reflexive at all.
The movie is more than two people talking, but a great deal of it is two people talking. And as the director, how do you keep that from just going flat? Because it doesn't, but I realize that's not an easy thing to do.
I think you hire great actors. And I think you hire actors who are compelling to watch and who are interesting to watch. And you work with a cinematographer and an editor and a costume designer and a production designer who help make it come alive. And I had an abundance of that.
And I love that actress who played the workplace psychic,
Michaela Watkins.
That woman is so funny.
Yeah, she's wonderful. She's wonderful. And, you know, it's such a throwaway role. She came in for a day. But it's a critical role narratively, you know, because she's the reason that we kind of connect with him.
But did you read a lot of pairs together, or did you just like these two people so much?
The actors are Lucas Neer Verbrugge and Aaron Costaganis, and they're both wonderful actors who are out of Tisch, you know, School of the Arts at NYU. They're both seasoned theater actors who are really great looking, and they have a lot of charisma, and they take what they do very seriously.
You know, most of my clients want something safe. They want something traditional. Two heads in the sky, something like that.
Wait, what's two heads in the sky?
Oh, you know, you've seen it before.
Big faces of the movie stars over a landscape. It's just so boring.
Okay, but aren't those movies usually boring?
Yes, but the poster doesn't have to be.
Oh.
I tell my clients, if we can distill the movie down to its essence and tell the story in a single image, then people actually have to engage with the poster. They have to interact with it. And, hey, maybe it'll make them want to go see the movie more, you know?
No, what does the client say?
They say, great, now let's put two heads in the sky. Which I do because I'm a tool.
I know I shouldn't care about this. It's just a stupid poster, but, you know, still, it's...
No, that's great. That is the guy that I remember.
What, crazy?
No. Passionate.
Do you know that coyotes only mate once a year?
I wonder why they sound so sad.
So, what's next in the pipeline?
I have written a script about Lyndon Johnson's chief of staff, Walter Jenkins, and I'm really excited about this.
And why do we need to hear this story?
Because Walter was arrested for having sex with another man in a public restroom.
Now I'm fascinated.
3 weeks before the Goldwater LBJ election, and he was a married father of six, Catholic, and was one of the most beloved and important and powerful and... respected people in Washington whose life was ruined and who's part of LGBT history and deserves his narrative to be told.
How do we find out what you're up to?
TimKirkman.com.
Okay, TimKirkman.com. Thank you, Tim Kirkman.
Thanks so much for coming out. It's so fun to meet these people after you've seen the movie. It's like, oh, real people did that.
Wenzel Jones and Abby Dees spoke with Tim Kirkman, the real person who wrote and directed Lazy Eye.
Ask the gays, who's your friend, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? You tell me.
The people who know me well know I'm a pretty basic guy. I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican, in that order.
When prospective Republican U.S. presidential nominee Donald Trump asked voters to ask the gays at a rally last month, he had not made rabidly homophobic Indiana Governor Mike Pence his running mate. Just over a year ago, Pence ruined his own rumored presidential aspirations by enthusiastically signing a so-called religious freedom bill that legalized anti-LGBT discrimination. As corporate condemnation and economic boycotts rained down on the Hoosier state, Pence's fumbled defense of the law became comic fodder for shows like NBC's Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Multiple times, George Stephanopoulos asked the governor if it would be legal for businesses to deny service to a gay couple, and Pence went an impressive ofer.
Is Advance America right when they say a florist in Indiana can now refuse to serve a gay couple without fear of punishment?
Well, let me explain.
If a florist in Indiana refuses to serve a gay couple at their wedding, is that legal now in Indiana?
George.
It said it would protect a Christian florist against any kind of punishment. Is that true or not?
George.
Does that mean that Christians who want to refuse service, or people of any other faith who want to refuse service to gays and lesbians, that it's now legal in the state of Indiana? That's a simple yes or no question.
George.
Do you think it should be legal in the state of Indiana to discriminate against gays or lesbians?
George.
Yes or no, should it be legal to discriminate against gays and lesbians?
George.
No one is better at playing yes, no, or George than Governor Mike Pence.
Ask the gays.
Yes, just ask us. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Jessica Andrea, Michael LeBeau, Dixie Trichel, and John Townsend, Bishop Gene Robinson, and Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Barbara Streisand performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Check out the latest program information and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins, Ward, Colorado, 2BAY, Byron Bay, New South Wales, WMBR, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.